This week on the Back Table Podcast.
You can get metastasis to the perirectal lymph nodes. We don't normally remove those, although you can see those causing local pelvic recurrences even when you think you've done a magnificent, thorough clean out of the true pelvis. So that's another sort of secondary echelon. Anatomic pathologists centuries ago showed you can get direct lymph node drainage from the trigon posterior bladder to the presacral space. And so, in an extended node dissection, we routinely remove those, and you can get isolated metastasis to that region.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Back Table Podcast, your source for all things urology. You can find all previous episodes of our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and at backtable.com. Now, a quick word from our sponsor. This discussion is brought to you by Veracyte, provider of the Decipher Prostate Genomic Classifier. Decipher Prostate is a test for patients with localized prostate cancer that can help personalize treatment. Every patient and their prostate cancer is unique, and Decipher Prostate can provide meaningful insight into the aggressiveness of each individual's patient's tumor. Because the Decipher score is derived solely from the genomic characteristics of the tumor, it provides information not available through already known clinical and pathologic factors. Decipher high-risk patients generally benefit from earlier or intensified treatment, while Decipher low-risk patients may be ideal candidates for monitoring or less overall treatment. Decipher Prostate is the most validated gene expression test in localized prostate cancer, with level 1 evidence in national clinical practice guidelines and more than 70 peer-reviewed publications, including more than 65,000 patients. Visit Veracyte.com/Decipher to learn more. Now, back to the show. This is Aditya Bagrodi as your host this week, and I'm very excited to introduce our guest today, Seth Lerner from the Baylor College of Medicine. Welcome to the show, Seth. How are you doing today?
Great. Good to be here. Thanks.
Well, I'm so excited to have you, Seth. You know, this is billed as a lymph node dissection in bladder cancer, but as I was kind of preparing, reflecting, it almost seems like it could be a Legends in Urology talk here. Your contribution to the field from the good old days to now, it's really unbelievable. I mean, the cancer genome atlas in bladder cancer, some of the first nomograms, predictive models in bladder cancer. I just can't believe how forward-thinking you've been over the course of your career. And actually thought maybe we could take a walk down memory lane about how muscle-invasive bladder cancer was treated when you were a resident at USC.
So probably dates back to my residency at Baylor College of Medicine. So I had the really good fortune of working with some amazing people, Gene Carlton and Peter Scardino. And Peter, interestingly, I know you had him recently on your podcast, and what a pleasure that must have been to spend time with him. Those of us who trained with him, I think, feel really incredibly fortunate. But Peter was trained in an era where he was actually giving cytotoxic chemotherapy for testis cancer and for muscle-invasive bladder cancer. So we had patients on a service that were getting MVEC. And why was Peter doing that? Because there was no real GU medical oncologist at Baylor to do it until Rush Lynch arrived, and then Rush took it over. So we kind of learned on the front lines about neoadjuvant chemotherapy and the integration to radical cystectomy. And, Peter, having trained with Don Skinner, was, very much committed to orthotopic neobladder, continent diversion. And then during my fellowship, I wanted to train with who I perceived was the best technical surgeon around anywhere, and that was definitely Don Skinner. And then when I spent my clinical year with him, I realized that this guy's bandwidth was just off the chart. He would do rounds at County Hospital every Friday before he left, usually before lunchtime, and he could hold court on anything, oncology, non-oncology, spinal cord injury, and it was amazing. And, I was drinking from the fire hose for that entire year. And Don, I mean, people may not know this, but Don had done, I think it was one of the very first adjuvant chemotherapy studies. So here's a urologic oncologist who was giving cytotoxic chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting, he published this trial, and these days it was not a very, you know, high quality clinical trial, but this is what he was doing. He was innovating because and to stay very much in front of the field. And then I think he's known for a lot of things, but he really, in my opinion, brought continent diversion to the United States. He by no means was the very first to do it, but I'd say that not only did he popularize it, but he approached it from a data-driven standpoint, reported his findings, and trained those of us who were fortunate to spend fellowship time with him how to do it. And so we went out and were the Pied Pipers of the Skinner approach to muscle invasive bladder cancer.
I appreciate you sharing that, Seth, and I think I certainly got a healthy dose of that when I was at Memorial between, you know, true luminaries like Bernie Bochner, for instance, and of course, Dr. Scardino. And maybe when we're thinking about lymph node dissection, bladder cancer, it does sound like multimodal therapy was part and parcel of the way you were approaching this disease. But let's just start out with staging. CT scans, top to bottom, contrast to CT scans, is that typically what you're getting here?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just like really any invasive or locally advanced cancer, you have to understand the patterns of metastasis and direct your imaging, you know, towards that. So, you know, lung, liver, bone being the most common, obviously lymph nodes being the primary, you can certainly get most of the information that you need with a high-quality CT, preferably with oral and IV contrast. And these days we're doing chest, abdomen, pelvis. And then, you know, bone scans, if indicated based on, say, elevated bone markers or, you know, bone pain or perception of, you know, particularly, I think, if you've already got evidence of soft tissue or visceral metastatic disease. But the world's gonna, I think, more likely adopt MRI, particularly the pelvis, for trying to get a better precision around the local extent of the cancer. You know, our clinical staging is just not that good, as you know, right? We're still calling 70% of these patients with T2 disease, and that's clearly not the case. You know, if you've got tumor-associated hydronephrosis, you've more than likely got a T3 tumor, and that's what it should be called. And I also think that making a good faith effort, particularly with tumors on the trigone, bladder, neck, to determine whether or not there's prostatic stromal invasion, because, you know, that can take a T2 tumor to a T4, and I would argue a bit of an imperative for cisplatin-based neoadjuvant chemotherapy if they're platinum eligible. But the world's also changing, and I think that circulating tumor DNA is going to play an increasing role. I'll just give you a very short vignette on a lady that I operated on last week who was brought to me with a high-grade muscle-invasive clinical stage T2 cancer. And I restaged her, and she didn't really have anything in her bladder that I could detect, but she had a chronically obstructed left kidney. I thought maybe it was from a previous hysterectomy in 2015. And so I went in and explored her, and lo and behold, her ctDNA was positive, because I was trying to figure out, you know, there must be residual cancer somewhere. She had a large volume tumor up in her proximal ureter, as well as a distal ureter tumor, which is what it presented in the bladder. So I think that you're going to see us, you know, getting ctDNA at the time of diagnosis, post-chemotherapy, post-cystectomy, and then following the patients along. And there's trials that are designed to determine, you know, the real value of that. So I think we're just going to have a lot more tools available to us to get more precision around not just T-stage, but micrometastatic disease. So.
Totally. I mean, like the modern study, for instance, super exciting study of helping adjudicate post-operative systemic therapy. So let's just say that you're sitting with a patient, muscle invasive disease, nothing kind of overly offensive on their MRI, CT scan, or pelvic exam. How are you kind of talking to patients about their risks of having micrometastatic lymph node disease?
Yeah, so in that setting where the cross-sectional imaging and also sometimes we'll get PET CTs or sometimes patients will come to us with a PET CT already. They may have even seen a medical oncologist. But let's say all of that's negative, right? So we try to get some precision around their clinical T stage, because even if they are a true T2, they probably still have a likelihood of micrometastatic disease of maybe 20 to 25%, and that's all, you know, most of that's going to be in the lymph nodes. So without ctDNA necessarily, that's sort of the conversation. And particularly, so the other thing we look at is any high-risk features that we can determine from the histopathology, right? So if it's pure urothelial, we would, without any high-risk features, sometimes we'll go straight to cystectomy. I just want to come back to the importance of multidisciplinary evaluation in just a minute. But if they have any component of variant histology, micropapillary, for instance, or say a nested variant, which is less common, or sarcomatoid, or any of those things are going to increase the risk of occult metastatic disease. And then the pathologist should always report whether or not there's lymphovascular invasion. If you don't see that on a PATH report for muscle-invasive bladder cancer, you should ring up the pathologist, say, hey, what about LVI? Because that also increases the risk of occult metastatic disease. So if they don't have any of those high-risk features, then it's a bit more, you know, I think you can do a all-comers, you know, one-size-fits-all. Yes, you should get neoadjuvant chemotherapy. But today, we have alternatives available to us in the adjuvant setting. If they don't get neoadjuvant therapy, we can still give chemotherapy in an adjuvant setting now that we know the pathologic tumor and end stage and can get a bit more precision around risk. And, you know, adjuvant nivolumab has been approved in that setting with or without neoadjuvant chemotherapy. But what I wanted to come back to is the importance for really all of these patients been, you know, having an opportunity to see a medical oncologist, because they're really the ones that can counsel the patient properly about the risk and benefit, the toxicities of the therapy, make a determination whether or not they're cisplatin eligible. And so we try to get every patient to go through that important evaluation, and then we get together with a medical oncologist and make a sort of a shared recommendation.
So in the spirit of multi-D, and I feel very fortunate that we have a multi-D clinic that meets every Friday. We try to see all the new high-risk prostate and bladder cancer patients. The prostate, obviously, with the volume is a little bit challenging, but with bladder, they're meeting a med-onc, a rad-onc, and a uro-onc. And just out of curiosity, at Baylor, is there a strong radiation oncology trimodal therapy contingent?
Yeah, it's interesting. I would say increasingly so. I can't say that the patients see all three specialists. We kind of try to do some risk stratification. So, for instance, T3B, hydronephrosis, that's not a patient who traditionally has been entered into trimodality or bladder preservation trials, although we have allowed that on the clinical trial that we just finished accrual to in SWOG. Or let's say a more obvious situation, T3B bilateral hydronephrosis. You know, that patient needs cisplatin-based neoadjuvant chemotherapy and a radical cystectomy, because those patients have never really been enrolled in trimodality therapy trials. Say a patient, you know, I think that the urologist needs to do a much better job in the patient with an invasive bladder cancer of looking for carcinoma in situ. They should use PDD, you know, CISView, blue light, even though the FDA-approved indications are not for muscle-invasive bladder cancer, but it can be quite helpful when identifying multifocal carcinoma in situ is going to push you one way or the other, because patients with multifocal CIS are probably not necessarily the best candidates for trimodality therapy, because the radiation doesn't really get the CIS. And so I think within that framework, we try to identify the patients who are good candidates for bladder preservation and get the radiation oncologist to see them very early. And then the other thing, obviously, is that, you know, the multidisciplinary tumor board, where you can, you know, have a frank discussion amongst all the specialists to come up with the best recommendation.
Yeah, and I guess kind of where I was heading, and even in the highly select, solitary, unifocal, less than 5 centimeters, no hydro, in my mind, I still have a rate of lymph node positive disease that's hovering around 15 to 20%.
Sure. Yeah.
And if you're generally giving a radiosensitizing chemotherapeutic is that really accomplishing the same goal as, you know, systemic platinum-based chemotherapy? And how do you kind of think about that? It's always a bit odd to me.
Yeah, so it's been odd to me as well. It's like, if we're recommending neoadjuvant chemotherapy to all these patients, why aren't we doing it, you know, in the patients for that we're doing bladder preservation? So I think that's an open question. We have a clinical trial that we're developing in SWOG to ask and answer that question. Leslie Ballas is developing that. Sia Thanishman has played a really important role. But the other thing that actually came up in a discussion of another clinical trial was bladder-only radiation versus, you know, bladder and lymph nodes. And the bottom line is there's no good data to say that you can accomplish local regional control with bladder only compared to bladder and lymph nodes. There was a randomized clinical trial done a number of years ago, but it's really a flawed study. It didn't show any difference, but it was a very poorly, I should say, reported trial and criticized among some circles in the radiation oncology literature. So it would seem to me that, and we'll be able to answer this, by the way, in SWOG 1806, which is a randomization of chemoradiation therapy with or without 6 months of atezolizumab. And we allowed really bladder only. I don't know what percentage of patients got that, but we're going to be able to look at recurrence probability in the pelvis, you know, with that. So I think that's I would argue, at least on for the radiation, to include the lymph nodes for the reasons that you just mentioned. But, you know, we're going to need good clinical trial data to support that hypothesis.
Yeah, I mean, one's mind could start swimming about true multi-D, where you do a lymph node dissection, which is generally a pretty well-tolerated, less morbid procedure for the nodes. And anyways, I won't go down that rabbit hole. All right, so largely we're talking about lymph node dissection extent. I did want to just pick your brain a little bit. Lymph nodes that have your attention a little bit suspicious. Maybe you could talk a little about size, number, landing zone, how you're kind of thinking about patients that walk in the door with some enlarged nodes.
Yeah, good question. So, you know, it's easy, straightforward for the patient with a single positive node. And I think most people use a cutoff of a centimeter or above, and we'll get PET CTs on those patients to, you know, you can have PET positive lymph nodes that are not metastatic. But if it's a positive PET in that lymph node, you know, we treat that as metastatic disease. And our general approach is to give 6 cycles of platinum-based chemotherapy as opposed to 3 or 4, which would be more neoadjuvant. Although a lot of medical oncologists are advocating for treating those more with a neoadjuvant regimen, which is 3 or 4 cycles, as opposed to a metastatic regimen, which is 6. And I think you can line up advocates on either side of that. Now, if you get into N2 disease, so 2 or more positive lymph nodes confined to the true pelvis, or N3 with a lymph node in the common iliac region, and remember that in this sort of revised staging now, you have M1 nodes in the retroperitoneum. Now, those patients, I would argue that N3 and M1 nodes should get 6 cycles of chemotherapy. And then what we'll do really for all of these patients, if they have a good response, we've been known, and it's not just us, to start really up around the kidney and do a good retroperitoneal node dissection. We'll do intraoperative frozen sections. There's some pretty good data for an MD Anderson to show that if you're in the retroperitoneum, if you've got persistent node metastatic disease post-chemotherapy, they don't have a good outcome and probably shouldn't be exposed to the morbidity of a cystectomy. But I would, but aside from that, I think that if they've got resectable N3 and certainly N1, N2, then our preference is to do a cystectomy and just get up another level. So let's say it's a common iliac lymph node, then we'll go up above the aorta and resect those nodes, make sure they look okay, and try to get a so-called negative margin, and then do a complete node dissection. But when we get to the clinical trial, you'll see that there's a slightly different approach to that.
Yeah, we've kind of gone that route, definitely in the context of a multidisciplinary tumor board. Recently had a patient, 63 years old, with nodes that are almost up to the renal hilum. Nothing crazy, not the volume, nothing encasing, but we were kind of debating. And as you mentioned earlier, I think there is some opportunity for us to learn more. Generally, I've kind of gone with the induction 6 cycles, restage after 4. If they're responding well, finish it up, do their cystectomy. Maybe now with an adjuvant option, one could make an argument that you stick out with the four cycles, do your operation, see what the path shows, and see if you should shift to nivolumab. Any opinions there, Seth?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think if they're responding to the chemotherapy, they need to get six cycles of chemotherapy. That's what the, that's where the data lie. I wouldn't necessarily rely on adjuvant immunotherapy to so-called clean things up. But, I mean, the other thing I wanted to mention is that we'll do a really thorough reevaluation of the bladder post-chemotherapy because that we're talking about the patient with, say, N3 or M1 nodes because, you know, if there's minimal disease in the bladder, remember that you can control that. I think you can control that with radiation so that, you know, you have that option. And patients, you know, that's the conversation that we have is you know, here's how this operation is going to go. And if your lymph nodes are negative, then we feel like we've got a stronger rationale for doing consolidation in the bladder. And if, let's say you do a RTUR and it's negative, it's like, well, what the hell am I taking this guy's bladder or this person's bladder out when they're starting with N3 disease or M1 disease when I can do radiation? We've done that. Now, those are anecdotal cases. And, you know, Neiman Devai at MD Anderson is probably going to have the best data out there because he's done a lot of genomics work in this setting. It's been a particular interest of his, and he and I have had long conversations about how to treat these patients, and we'd love to get to a point where we can do a clinical trial that actually answers the question. But he's on his way to figuring that out.
That sounds good, and, you know, it is a somewhat uncommon clinical scenario, and I think there's always this push and pull between going for broke, so to speak, in terms of a cancer outcomes and then the morbidity, and they always seem a little bit juxtaposed. Okay, so mapping studies, reliable patterns of spread, when you're thinking about lymph node metastases and you're with your fellows and the trainees, let me hear the Seth Lerner, we're about to do an operation, kind of, let me tell you something about nodes.
Well, it's data-driven. It's not opinion-driven. It's, bladder cancer metastasizes to the lymph nodes in a relatively orderly fashion. True pelvis, so that's, we define that as distal to the common iliac artery, common iliacs, and then retroperitoneum. Now, there are exceptions, right? So, it's interesting. Long, long, long ago, I forget the context, but there was some folks at Baylor doing some really interesting, more extensive, not mapping studies in the sense that from a surgical standpoint, but, you know, you can get metastasis to the perirectal lymph nodes. We don't normally remove those, although you can see those causing local pelvic recurrences even when you think you've done a magnificent, thorough clean out of the true pelvis. So that's another sort of secondary echelon. Anatomic pathologists, you know, centuries ago showed that you can get direct lymph node drainage from the trigon posterior bladder to the presacral space. And so, you know, in an extended node dissection, we routinely remove those and you can get isolated metastasis to that region. So, I think most of the mapping studies would suggest that you can get skip lesions to the common iliacs. They're not that common. Statistically, probably, if you take all patients with lymph node metastasis, you might see that in 5 to 7%. That's not a justification for doing an extended node dissection in everybody when the lymph nodes look clean in the true pelvis, and then of course, you know, pericaval, but usually para-aortic. So, it for the most part, it's fairly orderly, with those exceptions that I just mentioned.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think with PSMA PET scans and prostate cancer, we're seeing a lot more perirectal nodes than were ever kind of previously appreciated. The 5 to 7% is, I can't help but grin. Bernie Bachner, who I learned a tremendous amount from while I was a fellow at Memorial, he would oftentimes talk about the benefit of neoadjuvant chemotherapy, kind of right in that 5 to 7% range. And obviously, every higher echelon lymph node that's resected doesn't equate to cure, but you can do some math where you could wind up with a benefit kind of in that family. Any comment on that?
I think I know where you're heading with this, and I'm not sure that math is necessarily the right answer. I think clinical trials and randomization, you know, are really the way to answer these questions. You know, one comment I did want to add to the issue is that in patients with lymph node metastasis, when you do an extended node dissection, roughly a third of those, so these are patients who have N1 or N2 disease in the true pelvis, so roughly a third of those also have disease in the common iliac lymph nodes. So that's really been where the fundamental question is that if that's the case, then theoretically removing those would make a difference, right? Well, it turns out that that's, at least in the trial that we did, that doesn't appear to be the case. Because I think that, you know, once you've got that extensive lymph node metastasis, there's a very high likelihood that you've got disease outside the area, outside the surgical margins, and most likely, you know, micromets in the long liver or bone that's going to show up at some point in time. So,
what about space of Marseille? Is that standard?
Yeah.
So we're talking about the region medial to the genitofemoral nerve, lateral to the vessels. Is that going to be standard extended? How do you think about that, Seth?
Yeah. So one of the things that you learn, and we certainly learn that in the context of this trial, is so, you know, you dissect the true pelvis and you clean it out completely. So what I mean by that is circumferential mobilization of the external iliac artery and vein, removing everything in the obturator fossa, you know, above and below, anterior and posterior to the obturator nerve, lateral genitofemoral nerve. So you do all of that. All right. And, you know, you're patting yourself on the back. I did a great job. Then pull the external iliac and artery and vein medially, and you're going to find, you know, a bunch more tissue there, even distal to the common iliac artery. And then if you're doing an extended node dissection, there's all of this tissue that sits over the so-called presciatic fossa of Marseille. And, you know, I think all of us have seen patients who present with sciatic pain, right? So they're, whether it's bone metastasis compressing the sciatic nerve or soft tissue metastasis compressing the sciatic nerve. So we know that occurs. But the point is that there's a lot of potential lymph node bearing tissue, both proximal and distal to the common iliac artery. And if you don't, and if you have to look for it, and you should remove it in the context of either your, so it's what we call a standard node dissection or an extended node dissection. So we prescribe that, so to speak, and require documentation of that in the clinical trial for the patients that were getting an extended node dissection.
Okay, fantastic. So we've been referencing the clinical trial. And, you know, our listenership does include a broad swath of people from aspiring urologists to seasoned vets. Let's hear about the clinical trial.
Yeah, so I would go back a little bit in history to my upbringing by Don Skinner. So he had published a seminal paper, I think it was in 1982, and it was titled "An Unblocked Pelvic Lymphadenectomy Can Make a Difference." I'm paraphrasing it a little bit. But he had the concept that what he meant by on block was, you know, starting wherever you choose to start proximally and do the lymph node dissection, and sort of that actually sets up the rest of the operation, because now you got the lateral pedicles completely exposed, and then you can just kind of focus on the posterior dissection. Bernie came along. So Don had developed this idea that, you know, taking the node dissection at least up to the aortic bifurcation or even proximally up to the IMA, inferior mesenteric artery, would be beneficial. Because what he had shown is that patients with lymph node metastatic disease were curable, right? So we knew that from testis cancer, right? So an RPLND can potentially be curative. And he kind of took that concept and applied it and showed it was the case also in patients with muscle-invasive bladder cancer. Bernie Bochner came along and figured out that lymph node yield and thus identification of lymph node metastasis was optimized rather by, you know, still doing the same anatomic node dissection, but presenting the lymph nodes to the pathologist in packets. You know, seems pretty straightforward. Why wouldn't they identify it in, no matter how you present it? But the reality of it is that, you know, the pathologist has to be really diligent in examining all of the tissue that we send them to look for lymph node metastasis. So basically, when you do that, you know, you're going to identify on average probably 25, 30, even higher percentage of patients who have essentially occult, pathologically proven metastatic disease. Okay, so fast forward, and I always like to give a lot of credit to Bernie, because this idea for the clinical trial was really Bernie's. Way back when, he was working with the NCI in Akron to try to figure out a way to get it funded. I famously got up in front of a big meeting and said, oh, you can never randomize patients because we all know that an extended node section is what everybody needs, right? And I've had to walk that back a little bit. But I'm very active in the Southwest Oncology Group, and I ran the local bladder committee since 2009. I have the privilege of chairing it as of last summer, taking over for Ian Thompson. But in one of our committee meetings a long time ago, Ian piped up and said, you know, we should do this. We should do a surgical trial to answer this question. And I just jumped at it. I said, okay, I'm in. I'm going to do it. Bernie and I had been, again, it was his idea. Bernie and I had been trying to figure out how to do this. And so I kind of knew conceptually what this was going to look like. And then we went forward with it. So it's very interesting. So if you look at this question in other solid organ cancers, so gastric cancer, esophageal cancer, pancreatic cancer, in the same situation, not level one evidence, but you know, retrospective cohort studies seem to indicate that, you know, more is better, right? But in the gastric cancer trial, which was done in Japan, reported in the New England Journal of Medicine, it turned out, interestingly, that the patients who had the more extended node section actually had a higher adverse event rate, higher toxicities. And so we knew that this was a highly relevant question, so we just posed the same question in patients with muscle-invasive bladder cancer and designed a randomized trial to compare. Everybody got a standard node section, and then the randomization was to an extended node section. So that's the genesis of the trial. Like, just cut me off at any time.
No, I love that context. And I've got so many kind of thoughts spinning through my head in terms of, you know, there's the retrospective data. And I mean, partial nephrectomy for T1 renal masses, you know, there's all this retrospective data. There's a clinical trial, and the clinical trials sometimes get sliced and diced, and they were conceived years ago. They take years to, you know, in this particular trial, the rates of neoadjuvant chemotherapy were tremendous, 60%. Like you mentioned earlier, you know, cell-free DNA, those things weren't around. So I generally like to disclose most things that I think people are trying to, like, improve the standard of care. And I think absolutely this trial was intending to improve the standard of care. So well set up, you know, basically T2 muscle-invasive N0, M0 patients stratified with or without chemotherapy. They got their node dissections.
Yeah, so actually it included T2 through T4A. As you mentioned, clinically node positive, but we did allow patients with a single positive lymph node. And there we knew ahead of time that we would have to run this with a really strict quality control, because we knew we had to convince the peer reviewers and obviously the urologic community that this was, you know, done by high volume experienced surgeons and academic health centers that had tremendous expertise. So we did a number of things that I think are really important. This was I think we had 36 or 37 surgeons. They all had to be credentialed ahead of time. So we reviewed 5 operative and pathology reports and photos and documented that they could follow the protocol, do the, you know, they had to show that both standard and extended node dissection. And for some folks, we said, nah, got to send us some more cases to take a look at. So basically, everyone went through a very strict credentialing process. And then for every single case, they had to submit that same data. So often path report and photos. And with the exception of my patients, who Rob Svatek reviewed my cases, I reviewed every single one of those. And oftentimes I had a lot of questions. You know, I said, look, you didn't document this in your op note, yet the photos look like you did it. You know, you need to go back and give me an amended op report. And then we did a QC study that John Taylor and Kareem Chamey, who were not part of the trial, we set this up so that they reviewed 50 patients in each arm, at least one patient from each surgeon. And they went through independently, looking at the same 3 sources of data, and made an assessment, you know, was the prescribed node dissection done? And I would say that for the most part, the surgeons were very compliant, perhaps with the exception have documented the pre-sciatic or fossa of Marseille. That was a little tricky. And then we accrued on schedule, on time. We were anticipating between 100, 110 patients a year, and we met that bar. And what's interesting, and it's powered for an improvement in disease-free survival and overall survival of a magnitude of about 10 to 12%. And because of a lower than anticipated event rate, which happens oftentimes with these trials, we went the full 6 years of follow-up before we reported anything. And there was simply flat out no difference between the two arms of the trial, overlapping KM plots for both disease-free and overall survival. And you mentioned the utilization of neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So 57% of the patients got some form of neoadjuvant therapy, 88% it was cisplatin-based. So these are patients that were treated, you know, using the current standards of care. And now the other really interesting finding is that just like in the gastric trial, there was a higher rate of a grade 3 through 5 adverse events in the extended arm. Some of those are accounted for by mortality events within 90 days. We had a few patients that progressed in that period of time. We didn't really distinguish between cause of death, whether it appeared to be related to some sort of surgical adverse event or constellation of adverse events and progression. That accounts for some of that increase. So, you know, when you're sitting there and counseling patients on, you know, let's say, for instance, why we're not going to do a standard node dissection, you know, part of it is because there is increased risk. We didn't think there was going to be increased risk of toxicity, but it's there. And so, yeah, that's sort of it in a nutshell.
Yeah, I got to say that was a bit surprising. I mean, okay, first off, I guess first do no harm, literally. So we're seeing some signal that there could be harm. The benefits weren't there. And I don't think we really need to go through a whole compare and contrast with the German trial, which is a little bit different. Unless you want to, Seth.
We should.
You have any, we should. Okay, let's do it.
Should.
Let's do it.
Yeah, so the other sort of framework of this is Jürgen Geschwind from Germany started a randomized trial before we did. And I had actually reached out to him. We've become very good friends over the years doing these two studies. And their trial is, I would say that our trial is not quite a mirror image of their trial. There's some fundamental differences. They didn't allow neoadjuvant chemotherapy, and they included T1 disease. So ours is muscle invasive only. And so they have a relatively high percentage, I forget what it is, certainly in the order of 40% of more favorable patients, T1, T2. And the other sort of thing about their trial is their standard node dissection did not include the lymph nodes posterior to the obturator nerve. And I think that we all know that you're going to miss some lymph nodes when you do that. But he too, in their trial, and he was very kind in trying to hold off as long as possible reporting that trial to get us near the end of accrual in our trial. So he waited the full 5 years before reporting it and did not show any difference in any of the three outcomes of PFS, OS, and cancer-specific survival. Now, they have reported some longer-term data and at the EAU last year in Milan, it suggested that there may be a benefit to cancer-specific survival, but my public statement is that that's hypothesis-generating. And so now you have two really well-conducted, large randomized clinical trials, albeit with some different, slightly different patient population on one end of the spectrum. It's them both showing no statistically significant benefit to extending the node dissection.
So some questions, and thank you for sharing that. I think it does give it some context. Maybe the first obvious question is who and when now is extended lymph node dissection appropriate for, if anybody?
Yeah, so I think it's really important with interpreting the data from any clinical trial is to understand the patient population, because there were lots of people that were not included in this. So one of the other quality measures that we did was that the first thing we required was an intraoperative exploration, and particularly of the common iliac lymph node. So you would do that, and if there was an enlarged lymph node, you were required to remove that, send it for frozen section, and only if that frozen section was negative could the patient be randomized. So this does not apply to any patient who intraoperatively has evidence of lymph node metastasis outside the true pelvis, proximal to the common iliac artery. It obviously does not apply to any patient who has clinical N2 or N3 disease, and it does not apply to patients who have a majority of variant histology. All of your pure squamous, pure adeno, 80%, 90% micropapillary, this doesn't apply to those patients. And then, of course, I think when you're doing cystectomies for very high risk, with or without previously treated non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, that remain clinically NMIBC, it doesn't apply to those patients either. And I think you can use the German trial as a rationale for that. So, every time we scrub, I ask the resident, does this patient need an extended node dissection? If not, why not? If so, why? And I remember talking to a couple of my friends. They were so happy to see the results of the trial because they could stop doing extended nodes. We haven't stopped. I mean, I I think also if you get in there and you find, say, more than a single lymph node in the true pelvis, we'll just go do an extended node dissection.
So a couple of questions here. In my estimation, some of the surgeons involved are some of the most tremendous bladder surgeons that our country boasts internationally as well. And I'm curious, is this a surgical quality trial or is this a lymphadenectomy trial?
I haven't been asked that question. It is clearly a clinical trial that tests the hypothesis whether an extended node dissection improves the most important cancer-related outcomes in terms of progression and overall survival. That's performed and conducted with, I think, the best quality measures and assurance of adherence to the protocol and completeness of the node dissection that you'll find anywhere. No one's done this, and certainly nobody's done this in bladder cancer like this.
And, I guess as I was thinking about this, and this was an open surgical trial, correct?
Yeah, so that's another interesting question. I resisted. Ian Thompson would kind of bug me about every 6 months. He goes, are we going to allow minimally invasive robotic-assisted cystectomy? And I said, no, because we don't have any data to show that it is equivalent or at least non-inferior. Remember that there'd been some phase two data. Razor had not been reported. And so we actually stood my ground because I didn't want to get into a situation where now we had another variable that could affect the outcome. Although our statistician, Kathy Tangen, told me that if you want to do it, you can, and we can just account for it with a stratified analysis. But it turns out that we didn't need it because it just had zero impact on our accrual. And I also think that people, I appreciate that, I don't know what the numbers are, but obviously there's a lot of folks doing very high quality cystectomies robotically, and these data apply to that too. It doesn't matter whether it's open or robotic; it's a disease process issue.
Yeah, I was just kind of curious. The first kind of large surgical series came out. I absolutely appreciate and admire the honesty. There were abnormal patterns of metastases, carcinomatosis, local recurrences, things that you really shouldn't kind of see, in my opinion. And I think it was probably a heads up play. One of the things I observe, our residents, just like your residents there these days, are just whizzes on the robot, no question about it. And, doing a cystectomy, I think, is something that would be well within their comfort zone at the graduation, at a chief level, lymph node dissections as well. Cystectomy has maybe been democratized in some form or fashion with robots, like partial nephrectomy, for instance. And what is now a acceptable minimal lymph node dissection? And is that going to continue to get minimized, in your opinion? And if you don't have oncologists who think about the disease like yourself or other people that have spent some time studying it, is this a free-for-all to really omit this critical part of an operation?
I think it's a huge error in thinking along those lines. Now, I'm not criticizing you personally, because I think you're reflecting what some people have posited out there. So all you have to do is go back about into the 1940s, 1950s series out of Memorial, where they, you know, in an era where they didn't know they needed to do node dissections. And they had a 30 to 40% local pelvic recurrence rate. Well, guess what? Those are lymph node metastases that are causing that. And then when they introduced the idea of a bilateral pelvic lymphadenectomy, guess what? That local pelvic recurrence rate went down to 10 to 15%. So I think that there's strong evidence, you know, to support that a bilateral standard node dissection is part of a radical cystectomy. And if you're not prepared to do that, then you shouldn't be doing the operation. And you need to do, if you're doing it, you need to do it really well, because you can look at the data that are in from the clinical trial. You know, you should be getting, on average, 24 to 25 lymph nodes from a standard node dissection. And if you're not hitting that number, you're probably not, you know, there's a number of things. You may be doing a beautiful anatomic dissection, and there's no question that experienced robotic surgeons can do that. But, you know, you have to look at how you're presenting the lymph nodes to the pathologist. Are you giving it to them in packets? Or are you just sending right and left pelvic? Are you having a conversation with your pathologist about, hey, look, here's what, you know, you should be expecting and what you should be seeing? And then, you know, the other issue, frankly, is, you know, are you offering concomitant urinary diversion, be it orthotopic or chronic cutaneous, to these patients, or are you defaulting to an ileal conduit because you can do that intracorporeally and robotically, you know, and depriving patients of an opportunity for a different, you know, kind of quality of life and lifestyle. So, and then I think, you know, there's really good data to show that surgeon volume and hospital volume affect outcomes. So we required each surgeon to be doing, I think it was 30 cases a year in each hospital where they were up, where their primary place where they were operating, to do 50 a year. So I appreciate that residents, you know, were getting or learning how to do this in training programs. But unless they're going into an environment where they're going to be doing that kind of volume, they shouldn't do this out in the community. I just, you know, there's too much on stake, too much at stake for this patient population.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, it takes a village, you know, on the pre-op, the med-oncs, the nutritionist, the exercise physiologist, the whole gang, the ERAS pathways, the anesthesiologist, the post-op, the care coordination. Yeah, I mean, the operation's obviously a critical piece of the puzzle. It's not the only piece of the puzzle. And I was just thinking as we were talking about this, I love that data that Sia shares regarding his lymph node yields at OHSU and USC, where basically he was doing the exact same operation with very, very different lymph nodes, just kind of highlighting there's a lot that goes on into it. Well, Seth, this has been amazing. You know, I've learned a tremendous bit. I've of course followed this trial closely. I had the good fortune of training with Arthur Sagalowski, who put patients on this trial. Love talking about the trial, the history of the trial. If you know Arthur, which you do, you know, so eloquent and such a historian. So it's awesome to see it come to fruition. And, you know, certainly in my practice, I have seen the data and incorporated the data. I think the important caveats that you mentioned is, you know, the patients that weren't studied with this data, you got to just think long and hard about those clinical scenarios, the node positive patients, the ultra high risk, and so forth. But as we get on an hour here, Seth, what are some of the kind of parting thoughts for the listenership?
I live in an environment, and I now am responsible for managing an amazing group of people in SWOG, where we test our hypotheses and answer really important questions through the context of clinical trials. So that's how we move the needle. That's how we change and establish standards of care. And while all of us may not be able to participate in clinical trials or put patients on clinical trials, we really need to be students of the literature and pay very close attention, form our own opinions based upon, you know, how we read the literature. But, you know, anybody who's working in a urologic oncology field, you know, should really be well-versed in clinical trials. It's just how we get stuff done. And, you know, I'll continue to support that in any way, shape, or form that I can. And we welcome new ideas, you know. And, yeah, so that's the message, I suppose.
Well, thank you, Seth. I really, really appreciate your time and your expertise. Look forward to seeing the continued great work that comes out of your group.
Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, rate the podcast 5 stars, and share with a friend.
If you have any questions or comments, DM us at @Backtable on Instagram, LinkedIn, or Twitter.
Backtable is hosted by Aditya Bagrodia
and Jose Silva.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon, with support from
Josh McWhirter,
Aaron Bowles,
Nick Shellcross,
Josh Spencer.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz.
Social media and PR by Chi Ding.
Administrative support provided by Jim Lee Kinnebrew.
Thanks again for listening, and see you next week.